The Principles of Economics, Lecture 3. Fiscal Policy and Budget Deficits. The Good, Bad, and Ugly.
Hi, I'm Peter Navarro, and welcome to Lecture 3. In this lecture, we're going to learn about fiscal policy, which involves the use of government expenditures or tax changes to stimulate or contract an economy. In fact, fiscal policy is one of the most potent tools that governments have at their disposal to stimulate economic growth and create jobs. But as we shall also see in this lecture, when fiscal policy is administered irresponsibly, it can also create not just rampant inflation, but also significant budget deficits. And such deficits can, in turn, create much longer-term problems for an economy. To begin our discussion, let us together get into a time capsule and travel back in time to the United States and the start of the Great Depression and the birth of both Keynesian economics and the use of discretionary fiscal policy. The year is 1929. The economy is booming and at full employment. But come October of that year, the stock market crashes and sends the business community into a panic. In the language of Wall Street, the business community's animal spirits go virtually overnight from the full embodiment of a robust bull market to that of a bleak bear market. Reacting to the crash, businesses cut back sharply on investment and production. At the same time, frightened consumers cut back dramatically on consumption, while attempting to save more as a response to the crisis. Together, the reactions of business and consumers lead to a sharp and sudden downward shift in spending. Now, one of the ironies of this result is that in their attempt to save more, many individual households actually wind up saving less because their incomes are plummeting as the economy weakens further. This result is known in macroeconomics as the so-called paradox of thrift, and it can be an important contributor to recessionary events. In this particular case, with the economy in a depressed state, consumers not only tried unsuccessfully to boost their savings, business people, in turn, respond by decreasing output further. Moreover, businesses also became more unwilling to invest, no matter how low interest rates fell. Because of this depressed consumption and investment and ever-expanding layoffs, the economy continues its downward spiral and eventually unemployment reaches a staggering 25% of the workforce. What's a president to do? At the time, the president in office was Herbert Hoover, a staunch conservative and a follower of the classical school of economics. To Hoover, the answer was quite literally but painfully obvious. All one had to do was wait. Eventually, prices would fall and people would start buying more, wages would fall and businesses would start hiring again, and through this so-called price adjustment mechanism, the economy would bounce right back. Or, as Hoover himself put it, prosperity is just around the corner. The problem for Hoover and the country, however, was that prosperity wasn't anywhere near the corner, but rather receding further and further into a darker and darker future. As the U.S. economy and economies around the world sunk further into this depressionary morass, British economist Lord John Maynard Keynes had quite another story to tell. To Keynes, the classical idea that wages and prices would adjust downward and the economy would revive was just plain rubbish. Instead, as Keynes saw it through his so-called income adjustment mechanism, when an economy sinks into a recession, people's incomes fall. This fall in income causes them to both spend less and save less, while businesses respond by investing and producing less. This reduction in consumption, savings, investment, and output, in turn, drives the economy deeper into a recession rather than back to full employment. In this scenario, Keynes believed that the only way out of a severe depression was to prime the economic pump with increased government spending. This was precisely the idea behind fiscal policy And as an antidote to the Great Depression, such discretionary fiscal policy did indeed seem to work. For once, Herbert Hoover was replaced by the Democrat Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The government did indeed start to spend, first on FDR's so-called New Deal public works projects, and then far more dramatically on defense expenditures for World War II. Together, these twin stimuli triggered both increased consumption and investment, and the economy roared back to full employment. What we want to do next is talk about some of the key features of the so-called Keynesian economic model. This model is a staple of every college course in basic macroeconomics. However, unlike in college, we are going to forego all of the fancy mathematics and instead focus on the logic and intuition of the model. The basic Keynesian model provides a very straightforward approach to using fiscal policy to close a recessionary gap. At least in theory, this model may be used to calculate very precisely how much government expenditures must be increased, or, alternatively, how much taxes must be cut to stimulate an economy back to full employment. The most important assumption underlying this model is that prices are fixed. Keynes himself didn't believe this, of course, but Keynes did believe that when the economy is in the recessionary range, prices and wages are sufficiently inflexible so that income would adjust much faster than prices. Therefore, for simplicity, price changes can be assumed away in the Keynesian model. The beauty of this fixed price assumption is that it allowed the economics profession to develop a Keynesian model that focused on the relationship of the aggregate demand of consumers, businesses, and the government, and aggregate production, where aggregate production is defined as the total amount of goods and services produced in the economy. In this Keynesian model, the economy will be in equilibrium at a point where aggregate expenditures are equal to aggregate production. However, if at that point the economy is not producing at full capacity, there is a so-called recessionary gap that must be filled by increased government spending or some other stimulus to demand, like a tax cut. Now, please note this. This kind of recessionary gap I've illustrated along with the basic Keynesian model in Figure 3-1 in your course guide. Okay, one of the important insights of this Keynesian model relates to the concepts of leakages and injections. A leakage is income not directly spent on domestic output, but rather it's diverted away from aggregate demand. And one important leakage we discussed within the context of the Great Depression occurs when consumers save a portion of their income. If such savings are not injected back into the economy through business investment, the economy won't be able to attain full employment. And note here that while there are a number of different kinds of leakages and injections, consumer savings and business investment are the primary sources of imbalances in a totally private and closed economy. But it is also true that in an economy with a government sector, taxes represent an important leakage, while government spending is a crucial injection. Now let's look more closely at aggregate expenditures. In the famous Keynesian equation, such aggregate expenditures equal consumption plus investment plus government expenditures plus net exports, where net exports represent the difference between how much a country exports and how much it imports. The most important thing to understand about aggregate expenditures in the Keynesian model is that people don't spend every dollar they earn. Rather, they have a so-called marginal propensity to consume, which measures the fraction of every additional dollar that a person will spend. The largest component of aggregate expenditures is consumption. It accounts for almost 70% of total aggregate expenditures in the U.S. economy. Consumption occurs in three categories: durable goods, like autos and household equipment; non-durable goods, like food and clothing; and services like transportation and medical care. Keynes sought to explain consumption expenditures in the following way. First, he posited that there is a level of consumption that will occur even if a person's income falls to zero. Thus, despite being unemployed, a person still consumes some amount by dipping into his or her savings. That level of consumption that occurs regardless of changes in one's income is called autonomous consumption. Second, Keynes said that there is a level of induced consumption that will depend on the individual's disposable income, where disposable income is simply the amount of money you have left after paying taxes to the government. Keynes further described this consumption behavior in terms of a person's marginal propensity to consume, or MPC, which is simply the extra amount that people consume when they receive an extra dollar of disposable income. For example, some people may only spend 75 cents of every dollar of their disposable income and save 25 cents. In this case, what do you think will be the MPC, or marginal propensity to consume? That's right, the MPC will be 0.75. In another situation, people may spend as much as 90 cents and save only 10 cents of every dollar. In this case, the MPC is 0.90, and I'll show you shortly why the MPC is so important in the Keynesian model. But for now, let's turn to the second major component of the aggregate expenditures curve, investment. Investment expenditures include the purchases of homes, investment in business plant and equipment, and additions to a company's inventory. Investment in plant and equipment is by far the biggest category, averaging a full 70% of total investment annually, while total investment expenditures account for roughly 15% of total aggregate expenditures. In the Keynesian model, the important thing to understand is that investment expenditures are assumed to occur independently of the level of income. So, if investment is not determined by the level of income, as consumption was, it is useful to ask here, well, what are the determinants of investment? To Keynes himself, there were at least two important factors. First, he believed that investment was sensitive to changes in the interest rate. When that rate falls, investment rises, and when the interest rate rises, investment falls. Note, however, that while Keynes believed the interest rate was important in determining investment, he did not believe that falling interest rates and increased investment would necessarily lead to a full employment equilibrium like the classical economists did. This is because Keynes believed that investment was in large part driven by a second important determinant, namely the expectations or business confidence that businesses had regarding potential sales and profits. Keynes referred to these expectations as animal spirits, and basically he said that if businesses believed the economy was about to go bad, it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. The reason? Businesses would cut back on investment and production and thereby help trigger a recessionary spiral. Now, the third component of aggregate expenditures in the Keynesian model is government spending. This includes purchases of goods like tanks or road building equipment, as well as the services of judges and public school teachers. Unlike private consumption and investment, this component of aggregate demand is determined directly by the government's spending decisions in the Keynesian model. That is, when the Pentagon buys a new fighter aircraft, this output is immediately added to the GDP. Such government expenditures account for almost 20% of total aggregate expenditures in the United States. In the Keynesian model, increased or decreased government expenditures, together with tax cuts or tax increases, serve as the primary tools of fiscal policy that are used to counterbalance changes in investment and consumption spending. Specifically, expansionary fiscal policy involves increased government expenditures, tax cuts, or some combination of the two to stimulate a recessionary economy and close a recessionary gap. In contrast, contractionary fiscal policy involves reduced government expenditures, tax hikes, or some combination of the two, to cool down an overheated economy. The fourth component of aggregate expenditures is net exports. This component equals the value of exports minus the value of imports. U.S. exports include such things as the sale of airplanes to China, beef and oranges to Europe, and medical equipment to Canada. And U.S. imports include such things as Japanese-made automobiles, Korean-made running shoes, and, of course, oil from the Middle East. Because exports create domestic production, income, and employment for an economy, they must be added to aggregate expenditures. However, when we purchase imports from a foreign country, no such production, income, or employment is created, so that imports must be subtracted from aggregate expenditures. While net exports are a very important part of a global or open economy, they were not central to the development of the Keynesian multiplier model. So, for the remainder of this lecture, we are going to do what economists often do, make a simplifying assumption. Specifically, we will assume a so-called closed economy in which there is no international trade, and we're going to drop net exports from the model. This allows us to focus solely on the role of government spending in fiscal policy. But don't worry, we will deal with international trade and trade deficits in lectures 6 and 7. For now, however, let's put the Keynesian model to work. In particular, let's assume that the full employment output of the economy is $900 billion, but the economy is stuck at a recessionary output of $800 billion. In other words, we've got a recessionary gap of $100 billion to fill so that people won't be out of work, just as I have illustrated in Figure 3-1 in your course guide. Now, in the Keynesian model, expansionary fiscal policy can be used very simply to close this $100 billion recessionary gap. But before I can demonstrate this to you, I have to introduce one more concept we must master, the so-called Keynesian expenditure multiplier. The Keynesian expenditure multiplier is the number by which a change in aggregate expenditures must be multiplied in order to determine the resulting change in total output. This multiplier is always greater than 1, and the reason is that income is re-spent, not just once, but many times after the initial increase. Now, in the Keynesian model, it can be easily shown mathematically that the Keynesian multiplier is simply the reciprocal of 1 minus the marginal propensity to consume. That is, the reciprocal of 1 minus the marginal propensity to consume. And we did talk about the marginal propensity to consume already, and if you recall, the MPC tells us how much of every dollar a person spends rather than saves. Suppose, then, that the MPC is 0.5. In other words, a person is saving half of everything that they earn. If the Keynesian multiplier is the reciprocal of 1 minus the MPC, what then is the multiplier? That's right, it's 1 divided by 1 minus 0.5, or 2. That is, the multiplier is 2. Now, let's try it again. Now, how about if the MPC is 0.75, indicating that people are spending more and saving less than in the 0.5 case? What's the multiplier now? That's right, the multiplier is 4, or 1 divided by 1 minus 0.75. Now, if that seemed a bit confusing to you, don't worry. In your course guide, you can go and see how these numbers actually work. But I want you to use your logic and intuition here to see the bigger picture, the bigger pattern. The higher the marginal propensity to consume, the bigger the multiplier. And that should be very intuitive to you. The more people spend of every dollar, the more stimulus each dollar of spending will achieve. So, now that we know how to calculate the multiplier, let's put it to work. Suppose then that the macroeconomic advisors in the White House want to close the $100 billion recessionary gap that we have previously talked about. How much would they recommend to the President and Congress that government spending be increased to close this gap if the marginal propensity to consume is 0.8? Well, to answer that question, let's first calculate the multiplier. For an MPC of 0.8, the multiplier is 5. So if the government wants to close that $100 billion recessionary gap, all it needs to do is increase government spending by $20 billion. That's because a multiplier of 5 times the $20 billion spending hike equals $100 billion. From this example, you can see now why the analogy of using government expenditures to prime the economic pump is particularly apt. Such expenditures trigger increased investment and consumption, and the total expansionary effect is far larger than the initial stimulus. And that's the beauty of Keynesian economics. Now, alternatively, let's suppose we don't want to increase government expenditures to stimulate the economy, but instead prefer to cut taxes, a fiscal policy move much like was done in the 1960s with the famous Kennedy tax cut. In our example, does this mean that we just have to cut taxes by $20 billion to achieve our goal, just like we did with increasing government expenditures by $20 billion? Well, no, not exactly. The reason is that a dollar's worth of tax cuts actually has slightly less of an expansionary effect than a dollar's increase in government expenditures. Can you think of the reason why this is so? Well, the reason is that with a tax cut, consumers will not increase their expenditures by the full amount of the tax cut. Instead, they will save a portion of that tax cut based on their marginal propensity to consume. From this insight, we have to calculate a slightly different kind of multiplier, one called the Keynesian tax multiplier. It is simply the regular expenditure multiplier we've been using times the marginal propensity to consume. So in our example, our regular multiplier of 5 would now be reduced to 4, because 5 times the MPC of 0.8 equals 4. Do you see now how much taxes must be cut to close a $100 billion recessionary gap? Of course, the answer is $25 billion. Or $5 billion more than we needed to increase government expenditures to achieve the same result. And as I just noted, we arrive at this total by first multiplying the expenditure multiplier of 5 times the MPC, or marginal propensity to consume, and this yields a tax multiplier of 4, then 4 times the $25 billion tax cut yields the desired $100 billion expansion. Of course, if any of this is confusing, you can consult your course guide where I illustrate all of this. So don't worry, it's there if you need it. Well, let's turn the tables now a little bit. We know how to use expansionary fiscal policy to close a recessionary gap. But suppose instead we face an inflationary gap, a gap such as the one in the late 1960s, caused by the demand-pull inflation from the Vietnam War and Great Society expenditures. What's a Keynesian economist to do? To close such an inflationary gap, we must put fiscal policy in reverse. That is, we can either cut government expenditures or raise taxes or use some combination of the two fiscal policies to cool inflationary pressures. Of course, you might wonder at this point whether it is more preferable to increase government spending or cut taxes to eliminate recessionary and inflationary gaps, but the answer depends more on one's view of the appropriate size of the government than pure economics. At one end of the ideological spectrum, liberals who think that there are many unmet social and infrastructure needs usually recommend increased government spending during recessions and tax increases to fight demand-pull inflation. These actions either expand or preserve the absolute size of government. On the other hand, there are conservatives who seek to shrink the size of government, and what fiscal policies do you think they will advocate to fight recessions or inflation? That's right. Conservatives will generally favor tax cuts during recessions and cuts in government spending to fight demand-pull inflation. Now, from these various examples, you can see why the textbook Keynesian multiplier model seems so helpful. If you know what the actual gross domestic product is and what the full employment gross domestic product is, then you know the size of any recessionary or inflationary gap. And if you know the marginal propensity to consume, and therefore the multiplier, you also know how much you have to increase or decrease government expenditures or taxes to close the gap. Of course, if only life were this simple, none of us would have to worry about ever being unemployed again, and any of us, after mastering today's simple lesson, would be qualified to serve as the president's top economic advisor. But such is not the case, even if many economists at the height of the 1960s Keynesian era naively thought it was. Indeed, there are many problems with this mechanistic Keynesian view, and there may be no problem bigger than the budget deficits that expansionary fiscal policies can give rise to. So let's talk briefly now about the problems associated with such budget deficits. And let's again, historically, go back to 1999. That's when President William Jefferson Clinton proudly proclaimed that the U.S. federal budget would soon be in surplus. What was so startling about this pronouncement was that it was the first time the United States had run a budget surplus in over 25 years. And during that time, these years of chronic budget deficits had swelled the accumulated national debt to over $5 trillion, making the United States the largest debtor nation in the world. Under the presidency of George Bush, too, the deficit once again soared under the pressures of large tax cuts instituted by the president, a sluggish economic recovery in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and a significant jump in the defense budget associated with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In thinking about the problems associated with chronic budget deficits and a soaring national debt, the first thing we want to do is establish a benchmark of comparison. In this regard, economists like to compare the debt to the size of the nation's gross domestic product, or GDP. The reason is simple. In the abstract, a $5 trillion national debt is a very large number. However, such a debt would pose a far more crushing burden to a small nation such as Thailand than it does to the United States. Accordingly, comparing the debt to the GDP gives us a measure of a nation's ability to produce and therefore its ability to pay off its debt. When we make such a comparison, the news about the national debt in the U.S. is somewhat less grim than the popular view might suggest. Even though the United States has the largest public debt in absolute terms, on a debt-to-GDP basis, it does not fare as bad as many other nations of the world. Okay, now let's think about some of the problems associated with budget deficits. And in order to do this, there is one very crucial distinction we have to make. This relates to the difference between the so-called structural budget deficit versus the cyclical budget deficit. The structural deficit is that part of the actual budget deficit that would exist even if the economy were at full employment. It is due to the existing structure of tax and spending programs. Accordingly, the structural part of the budget is thought of as active. It's determined by the discretionary fiscal policies, such as those covering tax rates, public works projects, and education and defense spending. In contrast, the cyclical deficit is that part of the actual budget deficit attributable to a recessionary economy. It results at least partly from the government's so-called automatic stabilizers, those increased income transfers that kick in during a recession on such things as unemployment compensation, food stamps, and other welfare benefits. However, the cyclical deficit results primarily from the shortfall of tax revenues that arises when the economy's resources are underutilized, such as in the downward portions of the business cycle. Hence, the cyclical deficit. The reason why this distinction is important is that it helps policymakers distinguish between long-term changes in the budget caused by discretionary policies versus short-run changes caused by the business cycle. In doing so, this distinction helps provide a policy guide to tackling the deficit problem. For example, since we can grow our way out of a cyclical deficit simply by reaching full employment, Expansionary fiscal or monetary policies may well be appropriate in a sluggish economy. However, the only way out of a structural budget deficit is to begin living within one's means. That means either raising taxes or cutting expenditures, both of which constitute contractionary fiscal policy. Let's turn now to a discussion of the various economic problems created by chronic budget deficits and a growing government debt. To begin this discussion, we have to first recognize that the kind of problems the deficit and debt may cause are in large part determined by how the deficit is financed. To begin this discussion, we have to first recognize that the kind of problems the deficit and debt may cause are in large part determined by how the deficit is financed. In theory, there are three major ways the government can finance a budget deficit: raising taxes, borrowing money, or printing money. In practice, however, raising taxes is politically unpopular. This typically means that the government has to resort to one of two other means to finance the budget deficit, either borrowing money or printing money, both of which create their own problems. With the borrow money option, the U.S. Treasury Department sells IOUs in the form of government bonds or treasury bills directly to the private capital markets and uses the proceeds of the sales to finance the deficit. Note that in this case, the Federal Reserve is out of the loop. Note also that the U.S. Treasury is competing directly in the capital markets with private corporations, which may also be seeking to sell bonds and stocks in order to raise capital to invest in new plant and equipment. In order to compete for these scarce investment dollars, the Treasury Department typically must raise the interest rate it is offering in order to attract enough funds. This is because in the borrow money option, running a budget deficit is largely a zero-sum game. That is, the money used to finance the deficit is money that would otherwise have been borrowed and spent by corporations and businesses on private investment. In this case, deficit spending by the government is said to crowd out private investment. Crowding out is the offsetting effect on private expenditures caused by the government's sale of bonds to finance expansionary fiscal policy. This crowding out effect is one of the most important concepts in macroeconomics because it places clear and obvious limits on the use of expansionary fiscal policies to stimulate an economy. At least in theory, it's possible to avoid crowding out altogether with the print money option. With this option, the Federal Reserve is said to accommodate the Treasury's expansionary fiscal policy. In particular, the Fed simply buys the Treasury securities itself rather than letting these securities be sold in the open capital markets. To pay for these deficit financing Treasury securities, the Federal Reserve simply prints new money. The problem with this print money option, of course, is that the increase in the money supply can cause inflation, an undesirable result in and of itself. Moreover, if such inflation drives interest rates up and private investment down, as it is likely to do, the end result of the print money option may be a crowding out effect as well. Okay, that completes our discussion of fiscal policy and budget deficits. In the next lecture, we will turn to the other major macroeconomic tool that governments use to stabilize an economy, monetary policy. In the meantime, please do the exercises in your study guide. I'm Peter Navarro from the University of California, Irvine.
After listening to Lecture 3, a student posed this question to the professor: who sets fiscal policy? Let's listen to the professor's response.
In the United States, fiscal policy is set by the President and the Congress working together. What I mean by that is that if the President wants to cut taxes to stimulate the economy, he can't do that unilaterally. He has to go to the Congress and have the Congress pass the tax cuts. So it has to be a mutual decision. So when you think about who's responsible for budget deficits, you can't necessarily blame either the President or Congress. It's got to be both of them.
Another student then asked, Is there ever a situation where raising taxes can actually stimulate an economy?
This is one of my favorite questions because in some cases, that can actually be the case. And we had a great historical example during the Clinton administration with his Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin. The problem when Clinton took office is that there was a very big budget deficit, and the businesses around the country were worried that interest rates were going to go up and depress investment. And along comes Robert Rubin advising President Clinton to actually raise taxes as a way of reducing the budget deficit, with the idea being that if you did that, that would in turn lower interest rates and that would stimulate investment. That's something called Rubinomics in the real world, and it actually seemed to work, at least during the Clinton administration.
This ends Lecture 3.